Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 19th of October, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host this afternoon, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're delighted to be joined by David Scott with Northern Exposure, and of course, David reporting from north of the border. Well, the big issue that is under the surface of UK government is dynamite. We hear about Brexit at the moment and little else, but something far nastier and deeper is at work.
Well, yesterday, Penny Mordaunt was speaking at the Sexual Exploitation Conference 2018. And of course, this is following the issues around Oxfam and abuse in the NGO sector, particularly in international development. And she said, thank you all for your recognition that after the Oxfam scandal, we had to grip this issue. So I thought we'd have a look and see exactly how they're gripping this issue. They produced a nice little video, which all quotes from people that have been affected by this. They said that, Penny Mordaunt announced they were going to prevent abuses happening in the first place. They're going to listen to those who's when abuses happen. They're going to respond decisively and sensitively, and they're going to learn from each case that they're dealing with. So, for example, DFID and Interpol are launching a pilot of a new system to improve background checks on aid staff. UK NGOs with support from DFID are going to test a passport for aid workers to prove their identities, provide background information on previous employment and confirm their vetting status. They're going to introduce a disclosure of misconduct scheme across the NGO sector and prevent known perpetrators from moving around undetected, and a whole host of other things announced, which, what are they doing? Putting lip service to this? I don't think they're going to do very much, and certainly people from the NGO sector agree with that. She said for example, in consultation with victims' rights experts and the United Nations, DFID will be supporting the development of a statement of victims' rights. So this is all fantastic stuff. But as I say, not everybody was terribly impressed by that, including a former Save the Children employee, Alexia Pepper de Kers, who intervened during Penny Mordaunt's speech. So let's just have a quick look at that.
That's an excellent time for me to intervene, Secretary of State. A number of us would like to be on this platform, but we've been kept back by DFID and your attempts to control the women who are speaking out in this sector. Very eloquently put by Paula Donovan, who refused to get on a plane last night to come to this summit. She had asked to speak. Other women I am in touch with have also asked to speak at this summit to talk about the real change that needs to happen. And we have been kept back. We have been willing from the outset to do this hard work. We have heard this morning from excellent panels that women have been doing this work for decades, unheard, unseen. We do not need fancy new systems. We do not need technology. We need systematic change. We need to understand the sexism, racism, and abuse of power that happens from the very top of the leadership. And I was disgusted to learn on my way here to this morning's summit that Save the Children will be awarded a headline project to try and tackle sexual misconduct in the sector when they are still under investigation by the charity committee themselves. This silencing and use of us to come along to a summit as part of your audience and not to have any truth to power is what compels me to come up here and speak to you in person. It was very clearly put that there would be no time for questions and answers this morning. This platform is not, I'm afraid, for you today. It is actually here for the people who have been doing this work. I am angry enough to be here. I have left the sector. There is nothing in this about fame or fortune. This is about really giving truth to power. And I do not feel that I have seen anything from what you have been coming out with in your pre-cooked summit solutions to tackle that.
Okay. Well, thank you for saying that.
So what was Penny Mordaunt's response? Well, she went on to say that she's very sorry that some people feel excluded from the event. So, Brian, quite an important intervention there. We see this time and again, but the key point here is that she was making was that Save the Children, who she used to work for, have been given a role within this creation of this new globalized system of criminal records checks for aid workers. And as she made the point there, they're still under investigation by the Charity Commission themselves. This, that alone must demonstrate that Penny Mordaunt and the Department for International Development aren't taking this seriously?
There's so much to say on this, Mike, and the pause there is really my brain trying to take this in, because it's the first time I've seen this clip. But what comes into my head is participatory democracy, where these large charities and NGOs are no longer acting in that capacity. They're acting on behalf of the British government. They are considered part of the government. And I think a key part of the problem here is that we talk about Save the Children as if it was a big international charity. No, it's not. It's there helping to carry out foreign policy for the British government. So the British government ultimately is going to defend it to the hilt, even if there are people who are going to carry out sex crimes or abuse within that organisation. So an extraordinary intervention, but can we expect any more from Penny Mordaunt? No, I don't think we can.
Let's bring David in, David Scott in at this point. Welcome to the programme. David, what are your thoughts on what happened there?
Thank you. Yes, three quick points. I have seen this last night. I followed a link that described it as an outrageous and concerning security breach. That was the headline. And of course, when I looked at it, it was nothing of the sort. There was no threat. There was someone making a point extremely effectively. The second point here is that Penny Mordaunt clearly had no answer. And also we're seeing a pattern once again of the most inappropriate person or inappropriate organisation being put in charge of investigating wrongdoing. We see this over and over.
Absolutely. Well, let me introduce you to Rishi Sunak, who is the local government minister. They've decided, the local government minister has decided that something has to be done about government sexual exploitation at local government level. So the government is going to toughen the rules which ban sex offenders from being elected as councillors at the local council level. This is new disqualification rules to prevent people found guilty of serious crimes from serving as councillors or mayors. So, for example, anybody in receipt of an antisocial behaviour injunction, a criminal behaviour order, a sexual risk order, or who's on the sex offenders register will no longer be able to stand for elected office in their community. He says that current conditions make clear that anyone convicted of an offence carrying a prison sentence of more than 3 months is banned from serving as a local councillor. But the new measures are going to strengthen this further by bringing disqualification rules in line with modern sentencing to include the alternatives to a prison sentence. The question in my mind, Dan, is when are they going to do something about stopping people with similar problems from standing as MPs, Brian?
Who knows? At the moment, the so-called inquiry into Keith Vaz has just gone into the long grass. I think we're in 2 years into that inquiry. So Mr. Vaz was videoed there with rent boys. There was discussion of drugs. That's being investigated by Westminster, but all of that is now under secrecy rules, so we're not allowed what to happen. And of course, we've had MP after MP, many of them dead. Yes, that's true. But we've never got to the bottom of abuses in and around Westminster. And we're going to mention the so-called child abuse inquiry in just a moment. Mm. So there is no delving into child abuse when it comes to MPs. Fascinating to see, though, they are targeting local councillors, because we've already got the interesting situation where we have officers, so a paid employee of the council is also paid to do the job of, I believe it's called monitoring officer, where they vet the standards of the elected members. So you have essentially a government placeman in each council watching the councillors, but who is actually watching the council staff themselves? Mm. And the chief executives on vast salaries, of course, are going to do all they can to protect their own organisations. So I think this is starting to dismantle local democracy. I think this is what it's about.
David?
Well, I wonder here whether this is just an example of kind of locking the stable door after the horse has bolted, right? Because we're talking about excluding people who have been guilty of trafficking for sex, women and girls and boys into the UK. That does rather accept that these people were in the system, first off. There doesn't seem to be any attempt to exclude people who might be sex offenders sort of at source. And I understand that via polygraph and other psychological assessments, this is actually really quite achievable, but it's not done. So there's no real attempt to protect the public here. There's simply an attempt to prevent the appearance of wrongdoing where you have someone entirely inappropriate getting elected. I'd have thought that's something that the democratic process itself should be able to sort out, and not where the problem lies.
Indeed.
Okay, well, let's have a look at ICSA, and let's remember what the government's child abuse inquiry says. I will be heard. The inference there is very clear that any victim or survivor of child abuse will get the opportunity to come forward and to give their testimony at the inquiry. Well, we can tell our audience today, and I hope it is a worldwide audience, because this directly impacts on the British government and the values of the of present Conservative value, that the I will be heard motto is simply not true, because we now know that victims, survivors of child abuse will not be heard. And we'd like to thank this gentleman, Martin Noakes, who has shared a communication that he's had from the ICSA inquiry. Let me read it to our audience today. Dear Mr. Noakes, thank you for contacting the inquiry via email on the 10th of October. The chair is aware of Melanie Shaw's evidence and the representations made about the relevance of her evidence to the inquiry. In light of the evidence already available to the inquiry, both in documents and from other witnesses attending the hearing, the chair does not consider it necessary to hear from her at the hearing. The chair does, however, recognise the importance of the experiences and perspectives of all those who make an allegation of sexual abuse during their time in care, and the inquiry is preparing summary tables setting out details of the allegation of abuse and the complainant's perspective of the response to it. Where someone has made an allegation to the police and or the councils in relation to Beechwood, this is included in the summary tables. All complainants, victims and survivors of child sexual abuse are entitled to anonymity in the inquiry's proceedings unless they expressly choose to waive it, and so will be anonymised in the summary tables. Yours sincerely, Mr. or Mrs. Anonymous, Correspondence and Engagement Team. David, I'm going to throw this one at you. I do not think I have ever seen such a clear document showing the absolute intent that this inquiry will produce the best cover-up the British government has ever done to date, because we are not going to allow the survivors to speak. If they do speak, they're going to be anonymised, which of course dilutes their evidence, and we're going to produce tables which set out rough numbers of complaints and where they were. This is a cover-up which is just breathtaking.
It is. It's an astonishing response. The chair is aware of everything regarding Melanie Shaw, and the chair does nothing. The chair does not consider it necessary to do anything, to act. For Melanie Shaw, solitary confinement, driven from away from sanity seems to be the objective. A whole series of questionable procedures at every stage, but we don't need to hear from Melanie Shaw. It's absolutely outstanding. It's just, and then we get this. What we're going to do is, well, there's been so much child abuse. What we'll do is we'll summarise it in tables. Right, because that means that any one piece of evidence isn't that critical, because there's so much of it. All we need to do is give a general flavour of what's happening. Any one piece of evidence that might be concerning, say, a senior serving politician, for example, that one piece of evidence is only a small amount of the total. So we'll lose that because we're looking at the bigger picture. This is what's happening. This is cover up in action. I'm astonished it's so blatant.
Somebody in our chat box has said, I thought anonymity was optional. That's technically correct. People can decide whether they want to be anonymous or not. However, it now seems that the report is going to be based on anonymity. But of course, the other thing we've got to remember is that where the local council, Nottingham City Council, County Council, have made compensation payments, that has automatically come with a gagging order. I'm going to come back on to that, but we'll put this up on screen. It is clear that the Conservative government now is running this massive cover-up of child abuse. And as we said a few days ago, that we were receiving very good information, that they're so panicked by the amount of information coming, which is leading back to abuses in Westminster, around Westminster, by MPs, that the bet is that ICSA will actually close down the Westminster part of its so-called inquiry. I've tried to summarise just some of the key points here, but basically we invite survivors forward on the basis that they'll be heard. We then refuse to hear them. And to be absolutely clear on this, ICSA has not received any of the testimony from Melanie Shaw. That is an absolute fact. The bulk of her testimony has not actually been revealed publicly in any case. So you refuse to hear those people. You deny them access to the panels. You refuse to hear professionals such as the police who have evidence of abuse and cover-ups. We know that's true because John Wedger, former Met police officer, has been denied access to the panel. He was promised he could go on one of the panels, and ICSA has now said they're only going to deal with chief constables. We've got a government that's approved the gagging orders that come with the compensation payments, and that directly stifles criminal evidence. If these people can no longer speak out about criminal abuse enacted on them, then we have got a complete, stifling of law in this country. And then what are we going to do? We're going to produce anonymised statistical tables as findings, which will essentially assure that no individuals are ever found guilty of the crimes. It is mind-boggling, but to be expected, because as the UK column and indeed many other alternative media outlets have said time and again, child abuse is the fuel by which blackmail works within the British government. And to keep that blackmail working, you've got to keep the child abuse happening. And what do you have to do? You have to close it up. So here we are. We're in UK today, where we can show that the British government is working as hard as possible, the Conservative British government, to cover up child abuse. The same government lectures other nation states on the world stage as to how they should run their countries. It's obscene.
Well, yesterday, of course, Theresa May was in Brussels for the European Council meeting. And, aside from Brexit, we're not going to cover that today. She had this to say with regard to modern slavery and human trafficking.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. At this council, we've had a good discussion on our shared determination to eliminate people trafficking. And I reiterated the UK's commitment now and in the future to tackling migration problems upstream.
Well, by coincidence, the Home Office yesterday published their latest annual report on people trafficking and modern slavery. In the opening remarks on the document, Sajid Javid, who's the Home Secretary, of course, had this to say: since becoming Home Secretary, I've been appalled by the scale and savagery of this crime. Ending modern slavery is one of this government's top priorities, and I know it remains of paramount importance to the Prime Minister. That's fantastic stuff. What else did he have to say? The impact is huge, both on human lives and our economy, with estimates putting its cost to the UK as much as £4.3 billion in 2016-2017. Now, I've made this point before, but what this report actually seems to appear to be to me is it's almost like a corporate annual report which is showing the results of your particular business, your particular industry. You know, he's talking about the costs to the UK of £4.3 billion. that's money which is being spent. It's being spent in policing. It's being spent in social services. It's being spent in the care systems. So this represents profit to some people as a result of people trafficking and human slavery. So let's have a look at what the document says. Total direct government spending on modern slavery has increased year on year, estimated around £39 million in 2017-18 and £61 million in 2018-19. So 4 point something billion is the value of modern slavery to the government sector, at least, or the public sector. But we're only going to spend £39 million to deal with it this year. And we're only going to spend £61 million, not billions, million one pounds, to deal with it next year. This isn't really a terribly significant
sum of money to deal with the problem.
So, yeah. Again, it seems like, you know, this is the cost of doing business. The document goes on to say, improving the evidence about the scale and nature of modern slavery is a priority for the UK. Well, this is very strange because they're spending £61 million next year. But what it says in the document is that the growth of spending between 2017-18 and 2018-19 is driven by an increase in the UK's international activity. So that money is not going into improving evidence about the scale and nature of modern slavery in the UK. And in fact, when you look through this document, there is very little definitive evidence of the scale of this. There's very little evidence about the number of people affected, the types of slavery that they're involved in. It's all speculative based on reports from the police about people that they think might have been involved in modern slavery. It's quite incredible. I find the same type of attitude towards collecting information about the scale of the problem when we look at children that go missing out of the care system, for example, or children that just go missing in general. So let's have a look and see what they say. Their intention is to pursue, so they're going to prosecute and disrupt individuals and groups responsible for modern slavery. So let me understand this, 4 point something billion pounds on one hand, £61 million on the other hand, and that they're going to have a massive effect on disrupting things there, aren't they? They're going to prevent, not quite sure how, they're going to protect people that they have discovered are involved in modern slavery. And they're going to prepare by reducing the harm caused by modern slavery through improved victim identification and enhanced support. If you take all those four things together, the budget that they've got for this is not really significant. So let's just have a look at some of the statistics on this. This is the latest statistics. Now, this is the adults involved in modern slavery that they are aware of. They're saying it's around 47%, I think, were involved in labour slavery, and with children around the 39% mark. With regard to sexual problems, sorry, I've got that wrong. There we go. So the blue is adults, the green is children. So we find that sexual exploitation is a big part of what's going on with children that have found themselves in modern slavery. And I'm just going to put this one back up again, because although this is a worldwide figure, and so the percentages involved in sexual exploitation are slightly different, this is the scale of the problem. We're talking about a profit made from this of £130 billion, 21 million victims worldwide. I don't see anything in this government announcement which does anything about this. The UK is claiming that it's leading the world in this issue. And finally, I'll just mention organ harvesting, because although the statistics for organ harvesting as a form of slavery are really pretty small relative to the other types of modern slavery in this document, they're saying that they only had 3 referrals for organ harvesting, that they were all for non-EEA nationals, so non-European Economic Area nationals. 2 cases have received negative outcomes, and 1 case is pending a conclusive grounds decision. No organ removal was found to have taken place in any of the 3 cases. Now, of course, all their statistics, as I say, are based on referrals So people that have been found, and of course, if people are being trafficked into this country and having organs removed, and they are acknowledging that this is going on, then what are the chances that they're going to be found alive afterwards? They're probably being buried in woodlands or something like that. We don't actually know what's going on. Perhaps they're being disposed of in some other way. The point is, this is not being taken seriously. No form of modern slavery is being taken seriously.
It's just like words are being pushed out by the government to give the impression that they care and are doing something. But if you look at the reality of it, nothing is happening. This pattern follows north of the border, David. We're going to move on to the subject of Robert Green and his court case. But it's evident that the Scottish government is not that keen on shedding light on the abuse of children, child exploitation, trafficking.
If I could just reinforce what you were saying there about the scale of the problem. 2014 figures prostitution in the UK. The total numbers, 60,879 female, 44,085 male, 42% male, 58% female. Total value to the UK economy, £8.86 billion per year. It was 4 years ago, it'll no doubt be more. This is vast. It's fueled by human suffering on an almost unimaginable scale. And a few million quid is not the way to solve it. And perhaps of all the police resources that are spent policing minor roads issues, gathering taxation and policing hate speech, were actually devoted to doing things like raiding the saunas and finding out where the girls and boys who are in prison there actually came from, and following that up, we might actually be legitimately said to be doing something.
If I can just come in there and for a bit of clarification, really, for viewers and listeners, we've had a statistic of about 4 billion mentioned by yourself, Mike, as a cost to the country for this sort of industry. David, you are actually saying there that the government itself admits that it's getting value, £8 billion into the country as a result of this activity. So if we subtract those costs, what we're really saying is the British government is making £4 billion profit out of the sex trade, the trafficking, the human misery. And they're going to spend a quick £60 million to make it appear that they don't really want that £4 billion profit. That might be a bit of a crude analysis, but it seems to me that what the British government really wants is that £4 billion profit. They don't really care about the suffering. Hmm. Okay, well, let's move on to the subject. Sorry.
Go ahead. Just confirm that. The £8.86 billion, that was the UK Office of National Statistics.
Yeah. Okay. So that's not something that we're just putting on the table. That's come from the government itself. Well, let's move on to Robert Green. And of course, Robert Green was the man who stayed with the Holly Gregg abuse case, where Holly had been abused and clearly there was no justice coming forward. It took Robert Green to stick with the case, to report the facts and ultimately go to prison for his efforts in trying to protect children from child abuse. This has now reached an interesting stage because although many people probably think everything around Robert has died down, Robert has been campaigning for justice for himself as to what was and was not said in court. And we'll just pop her up on screen briefly. Judge Lady Smith is now north of the border, supposedly running the Scottish inquiry into child abuse. What's the link between this lady and Robert Green?
Yes, this is very interesting. Lady Smith picked up the reins of the Scottish Independent Child Abuse Inquiry, emphasis on the independent, after everyone else, led by the Chief Susan O'Brien QC, resigned, citing government interference and lack of independence. So Lady Smith is now the sole director of this inquiry. She replaced the three people formerly running it and is there personally directing how it proceeds. Lady Smith was the person who was asked to review Robert's complaint that the judge in his case, Sheriff Principal Edward Farquhar Bone, had made racist comments during the sentencing, during his sentencing at Stonehaven Sheriff Court back in 2012. These comments were entirely omitted from the transcript provided to Robert of the sentencing comments. That transcript came from the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service. Lady Smith was asked to review this. She listened to the tape. She wouldn't let Robert listen to the tape, but she listened to the tape of the hearing, and she assured Robert there was nothing to be concerned about. Transpires, that's not true.
All right, so we can show a little bit of the documents here to show people how this trail works. I'm going to say up front that, of course, at the moment, what was said and what wasn't said in court is not in front of us as evidence. So what the sheriff did and didn't say, we are trying to track down. So at the moment, we have to say that what he did say, some people are saying what he did say was this. That has to be an allegation. The important thing about this is how the system itself seems to be manoeuvring and obfuscating around the information. So the first document you were interested in was this one. Now, this is from the Crown Office in Scotland, and this is making one part of the report. Tell us about this document.
So this was given to Robert Green on his release from prison. He was complaining that the sheriff had made racist comments during the sentencing hearing, and that this showed bias, this being grounds for appeal. So the Crown Office provided him with this document. It's on Crown Office notepaper, and it's, as you see, quite brief. We've actually covered this in detail in the column many years ago because it's quite strange as well. But even stranger is that we've now, after some considerable negotiation and exchange, found that the original tape is still held. It's in the archives of the Scottish Courts and Tribunal Service. And after some discussion, they agreed to provide initially a written transcript, a new written transcript of the same comments. So when we see the new written transcript, which you've perhaps got on another slide there, we find that it doesn't match.
Right. And, this is the Scottish Courts and Tribunal Service who've now come into it. Have I got the right one?
That's correct, yes. Now, it doesn't match. Indeed, it doesn't match very closely at all. It's sort of like the first one was a kind of paraphrase. The second one clearly has been transcribed directly from some sort of record. We don't know exactly what. And lo and behold, there's an additional sentence in the new transcript that was entirely omitted from the original document. And this is what Robert's been saying for 6 years.
So we can bring this new sentence on screen. And what we're saying here is that this has never been seen before. Suddenly, we've got this sentence which has now appeared in a second version of what is claimed to be the transcript.
And it's a very interesting sentence. So this was omitted from the accurate record that was provided by the Crown Office and was confirmed by Lady Smith. And the sentence says, "Let me tell you that we in Scotland are more than capable of identifying our own deficiencies without assistance of someone with your background." Now, this is interesting on many levels. Not only was it omitted entirely from the initial record, but it covers exactly the ground, the sort of subject area that Robert Green and the 6 or 7 other witnesses in court that day all said was covered by the sentencing comments. It just does it in a way which is neutered, it's calmed down. It reads like what the sheriff maybe wishes he said. It doesn't comply, doesn't tally closely with what has been reported to me by numerous witnesses.
Right.
But
well,
it
we
covers
can,
the same ground.
David, we can to emphasise this point, we bring up on screen what members of the public who were present in the hearing allege that the sheriff said. You're either stupid or to Robert Green. He's speaking to Robert Green. You're either stupid or misguided, probably both, to think that you, a Welsh Englishman, can come up to Scotland to tell us how to run our justice system. I'm telling you that we run the justice system just fine. So that's what members of the public who were present allege that was said. I'll just jump back and show again what is now being said. The transcripts show, let me tell you, that we in Scotland are more than capable of identifying our own deficiencies without the assistance of someone with your background. But this latest sentence within the transcript does not agree with an earlier transcript posed. Now, what I'd like to just say to you is I was told shortly before we came on live with today's news that in England, it is normal procedure that although somebody is actually there taking down a transcript as the trial takes place, that transcript goes ultimately to the judge to be, verified.
Sanitised
before it is released to the public as a true version of events. I don't know whether the same system works in Scotland, but of course, if it does, this makes life very interesting indeed.
Well, it's an excellent question because we've been told by the Scottish Courts and Tribunal Service that this transcript is verbatim taken from the tape that was recorded in court. Now, they've offered Robert the chance to listen to the tape. So far, they're refusing giving him a copy of the recording for forensic examination. But they have offered to allow him to listen to it. So that's still to happen. It certainly is not consistent with what we've been told, that this has been a corrected version, because it's allegedly straight from the tape. It's a transcript from the tape.
Okay, right. Now, you have written some letters on this subject, and you thought that this one that you wrote some time ago to Lord Gill was of particular importance because you were coming back to the legal significance of this event. We still don't know what the true facts are, but this is giving a flavour for it by having a look at the dangers of bias in court cases. And you found this very powerful case precedents.
Yes, this is a 2014 letter from me to the head of the judiciary in Scotland, the Lord President of the Court Session. And I write here pointing out that back in the 1980s, a sheriff, whilst relaxing at Ayr Curling Club, pronounced that the coal miners then on strike would not receive legal aid if they came into his court on breach of the peace charges. Some of the miners later appealed his decision on quite different grounds to refuse legal aid. The matter went to the Court of Session. Lord Justice Clark, Lord Ross, concluded that the sheriff had not brought his prejudice into the court and that his decisions had been correct in law, but that was not enough. There must not even be the appearance of bias. Lord Ross said there is nothing to suggest that at the trials the sheriff acted unfairly. What the sheriff failed to note was that the interests of justice required not merely that they should not display bias, but that the circumstances should not be such as to create in the mind of a reasonable man the suspicion of the sheriff's impartiality, Lord Ross found for one of those appealing. Now, I say we've got six or seven separate witnesses, all of them reasonable men and women, who came away from that court convinced that there was grounds to doubt the sheriff's impartiality. These people are on the record. Their records, incidentally, were offered to Lady Smith, who refused to receive them.
Okay, so we've got a slide here with effectively your summary of this, which I can read out. You correct me if it's wrong. The transcript of the sentencing comments provided by the Crown Office to Robin Green was not accurate. Mr. Green correctly questioned this record. Lady Smith reviewed matters and failed to highlight the differences between the tape and the purported accurate record. Multiple witnesses present in court attest that the sentence admitted by the Crown, the Procurator Fiscal's office was not exactly as now stated by the Scottish Courts and Tribunal Service, but was far more damning. On the accuracy of this record stands the legitimacy of the entire action taken against Robert and all that has happened subsequently. I wonder what version will emerge next. Really, David, you are saying that if the public are not entitled to know what really took place in a court hearing and who said what, there is no justice north of the border, and there's certainly no justice for Robert Green.
It must be seen to be done. It must be transparently. As the quote there from Lord Ross made absolutely clear, there must be not even a hint or the suggestion in the mind of a reasonable observer that the system is less than scrupulously fair. It seems in Robert Greene's case to be failing this by a country mile.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much for that.
Okay. Quick reminder then, AV 9.1, taking place on Sunday, the 2nd of December 2018, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. in the Crown Plaza Hotel in London, in Kensington. So get along to that if you possibly can. Dr. Graham Downing speaking, Patrick Henningsen, Alex Thompson, Ian R. Crane, and of course Brian as well. So that's taking place then. And what else is going on?
We've got a talk tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock, at the Hamlin Centre. This is Bosham House, the main road, Bosham near Chichester, and that's on the subject of 5G. Which is obviously an extremely hot topic. So if you're local there in the Chichester, Portsmouth area, please do try and go along.
Okay, well, former Digital Minister Matt Hancock has made an announcement. He's saying the tech revolution is coming to the NHS. And of course, he's not talking about the latest technology in saving people's lives. No, he is talking about upgrading the NHS's IT systems and giving companies access, appropriate access to real-time data. So this is fantastic stuff. So what's this really all about? Well, of course, it's about privatisation, because as the NHS moves from being a healthcare provider to being a healthcare funder, in the sense of an insurance policy, then, of course, the providers themselves, the private companies, like Virgin Care and so on, that are going to be providing data or providing healthcare in inverted commas, are going to need access to real-time data. But who else is going to need access to real-time data? Well, insurance companies might, for example, all these kinds of people. So this vision apparently outlines plans to introduce minimum technical standards that digital services and IT systems in the NHS will have to meet. Having these open standards in place means systems will be able to talk to each other securely and ensure that they're upgradable. Any system that fails to meet these standards will be phased out. The government will look to end contracts with providers who do not understand these principles for the health and care sector. And so outside those standards, all trusts and clinical commissioning groups will have the freedom to buy what they need. This should encourage competition on user experience and better tools for everyone. It's fantastic stuff. And it's going to ensure a bright future for the health and social care system. And it's central to unlocking the potential of innovative technologies to support care. So there you go. The digital minister hard at work.
Well, that's reassuring, except the reality seems different. You had spotted this article, David, from the Herald up in Scotland. NHS Highland Medical Director Rod Harvey raised concerns about Regmore inappropriate bullying. And we've also got another one from the Scottish Herald, almost 1 million days lost in the NHS due to stress. Breakdown in the NHS north and south of the border.
Yes, the Regmore case, doctors reported that there was a culture of fear and intimidation, and this has a detrimental effect on staff. I'm sure it does. This came to the fore a few months ago, and I raised this as a question over name person. If the NHS are using fear and intimidation internally, what will they do to parents? But it seems also to be related to money stresses and strains on the system. And it's now showing in terms of the number of people taking days off with stress, and the days lost is now over 400,000 a year, work days being lost to stress in NHS Scotland alone.
Well, look, David, we're pretty much out of time, but we just wanted to cover the issue of hate in Scotland, and there's plenty of it apparently. But we start off with this from the BBC News: Police Scotland inspector and firearms sexism row. So how is this? Tell us how this is hate related.
Oh, this is just joyful, because Police Scotland are launching their anti-hate campaign, saying that Scotland says no to haters, and they're speaking on behalf of Scotland. Well, one of their senior officers put out the following email: I'm going to plunge in with both feet and open myself up to being accused of being sexist, writes a senior authorised firearm officer. He said, for operational reasons, I don't want to see two female officers deployed together when there are sufficient male staff on duty. This is based on my experience in firearms and routine policing environment. Other than the obvious differences in physical capacity, it makes more sense from a search balance of testosterone perspective. If you want to discuss, my door is open. He concludes, ladies, for the purpose of transparency, I've included you in this email. Likewise, if you want to discuss, my door is always open. No, that's not enough. You see, suggesting that there are any differences between men and women is hate speech, is absolutely banned. We're not allowed to think that. We're not allowed to say it. And Hamza Yusuf is not pleased with that officer and is absolutely convinced that neither will the Chief Constable Livingston be pleased. And that man is probably for the high jump. So that's what he gets for using his operational experience and correct and expressing his honest opinion. That's not allowed. Now, the next one is just actually quite joyful. I mean, this is a blog by the Wee Flea, who is a Free Church minister in Dundee, a longtime supporter of Scottish independence, who has now been ostracised in the independence movement because of wrongthink, I think. And he has reported the Police Scotland campaign to Police Scotland as an example of hate speech.
So sorry, David. This is the Police Scotland hate speech campaign. He has reported it to Police Scotland for being breach
being hate speech. Yes. Specifically, he didn't like, dear bigots, you can't spread your religious hate here. End of sermon. He found this was anti-Christian bigotry and hatred, and he reported it to Police Scotland. And the Police Scotland reply is unbelievable, right? Because Police Scotland came back and they said, right, we better quote this, you may be aware the following definitions are used by Police Scotland in relation to hate crimes. A hate crime is any crime that's perceived by the victim or any other person to be motivated wholly or partly by malice or ill will towards a social group. A hate incident is any incident which is perceived by the victim or any other person to be motivated by malice or ill will towards a social group, but which does not constitute the criminal offence. So under that definition, it's entirely subjective, right? So the Police Scotland definition is such that that Police Scotland campaign is a hate incident. But, oh, it's not, you see, because the Chief Superintendent, John McKenzie, then writes, Police Scotland have assessed the circumstances you raise, and the motivation of the Scottish Government campaign is not based on malice or ill will towards any social group. Therefore, the circumstances will not be recorded as hate-related. So you see, there are rules and there are rules, right? So they've just exempted themselves from their own hate speech rules. So it's everybody else, but not the authorities. The blog goes into this at greater length than we can today. It's well worth the read because he does explore the nature, the totalitarian nature of this control on thought and speech, and the fact that the government and the police are becoming the authorities over what you think and what you say, and it's not any longer a matter of solving burglaries and making sure people don't get assaulted.
Okay, well, I have to pause for a little bit. We have got some more we can add to that in due course, but we're up for time. David, I'm going to say thank you very much for joining us. You have said on many occasions that Scotland is being used as a test bed for most of this social engineering, and to see police becoming thought police in every sense of the word is extremely disturbing. Can we stop it? Yes. What we need is more flea activity. So it doesn't matter what you think you can do. If you only think you can write one letter, if you can only make one phone call, if you think your activity is as a flea on a very big animal, still take the bite, still take the action. Because if we have enough fleas out there biting the animal, it is going to become sick. And there couldn't really be anything sicker than the British state at the moment. Thanks very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Monday. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.